The approach I'm going to share with you during this course will not only support the resolution of conflict, but I believe it will also serve to help you teach others how to resolve their own challenges. So let's get started. I like to start out with the definition of conflict because many times we think we know what it is and it feels terrible, but mostly because we don't know from where it germinates. We ask ourselves sometimes, what in the world is wrong with you, don't we? And if we don't say it, we express it through our body language, which also seals the discontent between the individuals that are involved. So when you put it in real perspective, it means we have a way of seeing the situation that's based on our own worldview. And since most of our worldviews couldn't possibly be wrong, then my goal in the conflict or in the situation is to protect my way of thinking or to protect my rightness. I want to take an even deeper dive into what this looks like when it comes to resolving conflict. So what you have here is an image, and each person sees different sides of the image. When you take a step back, they both appear right on the surface. Here is a simple way of looking at what I've just described. Both appear to be correct. Is what I often tell people is, yes, you have a very valid point of view, because that's what people need to hear in order for you to get their attention and get them to look up and to really take a step back and see exactly what's going on. And from there, you invite them to look at the big picture and then help them to individually or as a group walk around to other people's way of seeing things, all without losing themselves. These are times when you can say, well, you both or you all have very valid points. Now what should we do? This will help to get them to start solving their own problems. And here's why. Here's what's behind the mask. Here's what people are protecting. When you argue a point, or when other people argue a point, what they feel is that you're telling them that everything they know that created or that fed into that thought, their experience, their knowledge, their upbringing, their beliefs, their culture, their education, all of these things, what they are feeling is that you're saying that those might not be accurate or just plain wrong. Therefore, as I've said before, I have to protect my worldview because I can't be wrong. That might invalidate who I am. And when you disagree with someone, the emotional, intelligent person will see that it's just a different opinion, and they can get to a higher level of intelligence or achieve self-awareness and self-management much more quickly than the person who sees the disagreement as a total hit on everything they hold to be true. If we don't take action to really get ahead of and to teach individuals and leaders how to resolve the conflict, not only will productivity and engagement decline, but it will also erode at your bottom line. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Look at that cost of conflict. Now, this is just a snippet of information that I've been able to call in my own research about what conflict is costing organizations and teams and leaders in trying to achieve their goals. You got numbers from 85% of employees deal with it to 29% of that 85% on a constant basis, to 9% of people surveyed have seen workplace conflict cause a project to fail. And in fact, I kid you not, I was just on a call with a leader this morning who is dealing with an environment that she calls just completely hostile. And she's trying to figure out what it is and how to do it and how to navigate, because the person who is causing all of this conflict is the CEO. So imagine what that conflict is costing. They've had turnover. They've had individuals who've been tardy, who've been late. They're not able to completely achieve their goals. And all of this at the hand of an individual who has no self-control and is not at all self-aware. So it's costing them something. And I asked her to simply count up the cost of that conflict. Let's take another step a little bit deeper into this measuring the cost and the value even of conflict in an organization. I had a colleague who used to repeatedly say to one another and to other executives around the table, let's just do the math. And by the time I left, I swear we were all measuring everything, wearing the t-shirt, the button, the baseball cap, and all of those things around measurements. And I was measuring everything from the amount of money, including the labor it took to put on a networking event or a conference, to the cost of holding an everyday meeting. And I'm completely serious about that. That's for another topic. We'll talk about that somewhere down the line. But just count up the salaries that go into the meetings that you always find yourself in. And then you'll look for ways to delegate even more. Additionally, what does it cost? And I mean, what does it really cost the organization when individuals or teams are embroiled in conflict? It is never, ever contained. It's like a fire that spreads quickly and it has to be extinguished. So look at the direct costs, look at the productivity costs, and look at the continuity and psychological costs of the conflict. And conversely, when you look to embrace conflict, I want you to look at the value of resolving conflict. Put simply, we want people to work together, but we are naive if we believe we're always going to get along, because when individuals get together to work toward that goal, to achieve that strategic intent, conflict is bound to happen. Remember what I shared about each person's mental model? Well, here it is, each one with a way of achieving excellence. So you have stakeholder A, stakeholder B, and you have stakeholder C. Each of them who bring various degrees of experience, levels of experience, degrees of expertise to the table, and we're trying to achieve excellence. We call this strategic intent. And each person, based on their mental model, their worldview, their frame, and the reference of seeing things, to seek to achieve that excellence in their way. Then you create a disorienting dilemma that usually occurs when people have these experiences that don't fit their worldview. And as such, it doesn't make sense to them and they cannot resolve the situation without some change in their views of the world. The disorienting dilemma is simply the problem that's presented or the challenge that you share. It requires that individuals make a shift in their view of how they do things and how they see things. It actually adds a notch to their belt and their ability to solve future challenges and to see others' perspectives. What this results in is conflict. When you bring people together and you disrupt their way of seeing things, they're going to say to themselves, well, my worldview can't be wrong, therefore I must make this right. That's what they're saying to themselves when they have conflict. Each and every person that's a stakeholder in that conversation or in that experience. Your goal is to help them move through the conflict in order to achieve organizational success. In this slide, what you see is a brain. And entangled in my worldview are my emotions. And every emotion passes through your brain. There's no way to separate this. That's why dealing with conflict at work is so challenging, because we're human and we are hardwired to give our emotions the upper hand. And those of us who are able to recognize and manage our emotions more quickly are able to gain perspective about a situation and then make some rational decisions. Others, not so much. This is why the demand for emotional intelligence has really grown over the years. We need rational thinkers who cannot ignore their emotions, but leverage them to achieve a higher level of intelligence. In other words, to help the organization achieve its goals. When others are not at their emotional best, what you're going to find is that you're talking people down from the height of an emotional state that they're going to find themselves in. And I'm going to give you some strategies for how to help talk them down out of that emotional state. As part of this toolkit that I want to help you build, I want to talk about conflict coaching, because you can't exactly talk someone down off a ledge or down from the height of their emotions if you don't have some basic skills and basic understanding of conflict coaching. It is a present and future focused conversation that more and more organizations are adopting as part of their business culture. The primary reason it works is because when you have a conversation with individuals, it's unlike any other sort of corrective measure because it involves the engaged individual in the solution. You're not just telling them what to do. They have to make some decisions about exactly what it is they want to do. You don't have to do anything but guide the conversation, and they will do all the work. I've had licensed therapists and psychiatrists tell me they are going to use coaching more than they use their skill of practice in many respects, because they realize that now they have a toolkit from which to use. They can either go into a psychological or a therapeutic conversation, or they can recognize that individuals might need coaching as opposed to something a little more significant for to help them resolve their issue. Here are some opportunities to apply this practice. For example, people who are not comfortable in group processes, individuals who recognize that there's recurring conflict and they just can't move on, and people who feel stuck. No, they just need to get some help to move forward and get out of a conflict situation. These are very common kinds of situations. The last two involve individuals who want to improve their communication with a peer or a supervisor, and then individuals who want to help an employee improve their communication skills. In all of these situations, and then some, conflict coaching can be applied. And remember this one important thing, that conflict coaching should never, ever be punitive. Never. Otherwise, people will not feel engaged in the process. They will not see the value. They will not buy in, and you will end up in a different type of conversation. Let's talk about now some underlying causes of conflict. I've listed a number of reasons why conflict occurs. In addition to having a worldview that's different from others, these are what I call fire starters to conflict. Now, what I mean by these external factors that I have on this bullet is that these are personal situations, right? Perhaps conversations that occurred on the way to work or the night before, could have been with a family member, a friend, a stranger, a colleague, but something happened outside of the office, and that something is causing conflict with the individual and more broadly within the organization. Maybe something someone said on television, and we're all glued to some channel at some point in the history of where we are in our world. All of these factors are factors we simply cannot control. They're external to the work environment, but we have to respond to them. We have a responsibility to respond to those as well as to the other bullet points that we see here on the slide. So how then is listening helpful in resolving conflict? The first thing we have to do is to listen. And I mean listen to what is being said and to what is not being said, so that you can recognize triggers and hot buttons that might provoke a negative interaction, identify the underlying source of conflict, which is not something that most people who are involved in employee relations and other kinds of resolution skills in the organization are accustomed to doing. We just want to get in and say who's right, who's wrong, make a decision and move forward. And then finally, making sure that we recognize patterns of conflict situations. When you listen carefully, you can pick up on things that may be indicators of some patterns in this individual or in the scenario itself inside the organization. Here are two additional ways that we can use when we're practicing, things that we can keep in mind when we're practicing listening. You actually stop talking, believe it or not, when you're listening. You give the other individual or the group your full attention, and you provide, and that attention, actually that listening, can give you clues as to what's actually going on. Once you've listened, then I want you to take some time to let people know what you've heard. And I want you to do that using their words whenever possible, because when you use other people's words and not paraphrase and reword things, they don't feel judged and they believe that you actually were paying attention, because you were, or else you couldn't use their words. So think about all five of these points as you are engaging or helping to resolve conflict in the organization. The next thing I want you to take a look at is yourself in the mirror, to be quite honest. I want you to first look at yourself when it comes to resolving conflict and ask yourself these questions, whether you're the person in conflict or whether you're the person about to set up a conversation to resolve conflict. Think about, what do you want the others to walk away thinking or feeling? You know, what might be their position? Not so you can launch a counterattack, but just so you can walk around to the other side to see whether or not this is an M or W, whether this is a 6 or a 9. Like, what's going on here? These are questions that will allow you to know what type of conflict you're engaging in and what type of conversation you need to set up. It also will allow you and the others to think about the environment that you want to set and to create that psychologically safe environment that people need to resolve conflict. If you're facilitating that conversation, think on these, and then you can even ask the others to think on some of these questions, if not all of them, before coming to the meeting. You can use the answers to some of these to even set up the ground rules or jumpstart the in-person conversation that you're going to have to resolve the conflict. When we look at constructing the actual conversation to this innovative problem-solving conflict scenario situation, because you're most likely to be emotionally controlled or the most emotionally controlled person in the room, I think the first thing you need to do is set up some ground rules. I think that will be an effective way to create a feeling of emotional psychological safety that I talk about repeatedly, because I think this is so important for conflict. What this does is it lets them know that if they can't control their emotions, you may have no choice but to move the conversation from coaching to perhaps another level in the disciplinary process in your organization. So the choice is theirs. You give them the choice when you set up the ground rules. This has a way of helping to control the temperature in the room, and you can ask for clarifying questions of the situation if your summary of the understanding is not quite accurate. So you move from setting up the ground rules to getting clarity about what's actually going on, and that moves much quicker, much more smoothly when you've already set up those ground rules. Now, some people will ask, should they speak to one another in this situation or speak to you? And you know, what I say is have them speak to you directly, and throughout the conversation, as they begin to interact and really rebuild some foundation to the relationship, the conversation is going to naturally shift to them speaking to one another. As long as they do so with respect, I think that that's okay. But you have to ask each of them, you know, how do they perceive what the other person's needs are? And that'll actually get you closer to a faster resolution, and how they can see they're shifting from one position, their own, into a more collaborative way of seeing their way out of this conflict. In these final three points in how to engage in constructive and innovative problem solving, you should have come to a place by now where you can discuss and sort of evaluate options in this conversation. And whenever possible, I want you to make sure there are more options on the table than there are a number of people involved in the conflict. If there are two people in a conflict and you're helping to resolve this conflict, make sure there are more than two options to the resolution, because this forces them beyond their own point of view. If you have three or four people in a conversation, there needs to be three or four more options to solving this situation than the number of individuals in the room, because we're always going to put out our own solution. We're still going to be stuck in our mental models. When you get to point 6 and 7, then here on the slide, then this might help you move this conversation and really seal the deal. I'll give you a couple of questions, for example. I want each of you to talk about your confidence in positive terms, how you're going to manage this situation for long-term sustainability. So that's one question that you can ask. Another question might be, what have you learned about yourselves or one another today? Questions like these ensure the situation ends on a higher note than when you may have started, and bridges the gap for more long-term positive interaction between these individuals. To wrap up this segment, I want to give you a couple of homework assignments. One is, I want you to think about how emotionally intelligent you are. There's no excuse. As a leader, we should know what our degree of EQ is. What's our score? Take the assessment. We have an assessment that we can certainly provide. There are books that have assessments in them. Whatever path you decide to take, I want you to assess your emotionally intelligent score. I want you to assess your level of emotional intelligence. Take the assessment that we have. You can buy a book that has an emotional intelligence assessment in it. Whatever path you decide to take, whether it's a free and online assessment, I want you to be able to assess and know definitively what your emotional intelligence score is. And then I want you to identify from this segment the thing that you're going to measure. Identify the one thing this week that you're going to measure and report on. Time spent addressing conflicts, time spent in meetings. What's the thing that you're going to measure so you can report on the value or the distress that conflict is causing on the organization? How much is conflict costing the organization? So you're going to identify what your emotional intelligence level is. You're going to identify at least one thing that you can measure as it relates to conflict. And then the third thing that I want you to do is I want you to practice becoming a better listener. Now let's learn how conflict can actually boost your bottom line when it's properly managed, because all conflict has the ability to be good if we harness it and we learn from it. So let's talk further. Embracing conflict can actually improve productivity, interpersonal engagement, and a much more positive work culture. You can teach people how to resolve conflicts by adopting a coaching culture. That's really how simple it can be, but organizations are often afraid of conflict because you have people who are afraid of conflict. And what I want to do is to dismantle that fear and help you to really embrace it and think of ways that you can leverage it inside the organization. Let's start with managing conflict for strategic impact. Now, I've given you a couple of bullet points, and this is actually a little heads up, going to be a part of your homework as you move through this course. Here is how you harness the power of conflict. Think of conflict at work as you might think of it at home. You know, when you've had conflicts at home, they feel terrible in the moment, but eventually they get resolved and you realize you've learned something more about the other person. And you use that learning to better understand the person you live with or the person that you're around so that you can have better conversations in the future. So when you think about it, the only difference at work is that at home, there's often this feeling that it must be resolved because you can't escape it and you need to restore peace, almost as if you have no choice, right? At work, however, we sometimes feel we have choices. We say things like, I don't have to see you after hours, or I can avoid you. When in reality, this passive aggressiveness is what can't be ignored. You might be able to try to ignore them during the work hours, but you're spending a lot of time, a lot of your waking hours in conflict. And unfortunately, what's overlooked is the fact that when you spend waking hours in conflict, even when you leave that person's presence, that conflict can follow you in your thoughts and in your mind and in your behavior. Let's look at some ways to turn bad conflict into useful conflict. When you're called upon to resolve conflict, because I'm hoping that you're not the one involved in conflict, but that can occur, and this can be very helpful whether you're involved or whether you're managing the conflict in the organization. But I want you to make sure you're clear about what's really going on and try to get to the source of the conflict. If you do not, it will erupt again somewhere down the line. Remember, conflict is like a raging fire. It has to be extinguished, but you got to manage it before you can extinguish it. You have to contain the fire so that you can figure out how to fully extinguish it. When you harness conflict and you seek to learn from it, you will see the culture shift. People often ask me, how long does it take to change a culture? And how long, you know, can we put some practices in place? Because this is a negative or, you know, a terrible culture that we're in, or whatever people are saying about their cultures at work. And often when the leader comes in, the culture can shift. But even if leadership doesn't change, you can actually manage conflict and see a shift in the culture. You will not only see people continue to get in conflict. This is not what this is about. What you're going to start to learn is how to leverage the conflict for broader learning inside the organization, where you've identified ways to improve how people interact and communicate with one another. And we'll talk more about how to leverage conflict here in a second. But I don't want you to walk away thinking, oh, we're going to get rid of all conflict. No, conflict is necessary for organizational growth and exponential achievement of success. It's just what you do with conflict that can lead to diminished returns. Here's what I'm talking about. The research about diversity and inclusion always wins. What it means is there is a lot of information, a lot of research out there about diversity and inclusion. And this is just a snippet of that information. But what I want to do is talk about it from the perspective of conflict, because it's so much easier for us to work with people we know and who have similar backgrounds and experiences. We fall in love with these people. They become our friends. This commonality is actually what makes for harmony. And every organization wants harmony. But all of this homogeneity means that you might not be getting the innovation and competitive success you so desperately want to continue business growth. Mostly because if we like each other and we all get along, someone might think, who am I to disrupt this harmony by disagreeing with you? So we continue without expressing opposition by a large majority because we can't handle the conflict, or we know that the conflict will be handled poorly. So we go along with the status quo in order to maintain the harmony, which does not get us the type of success that we'd like to achieve. Here's another image that depicts what I'm referring to. Homogeneous cultures get along and they do achieve success. But groups that are cognitively diverse, those who bring different worldviews and experiences to the table, always achieve greater results. But if and only if the conflict is not contained, but managed instead. So in other words, you don't squash an argument, you leverage that argument, you leverage that disagreement for broader learning by the team, by the individuals, and by the organization. So your homework assignment after this section is to identify at least two of these things that you're going to put into play in the next 90 days. Remember, I told you this list was going to come back to you. Which two of these items will you be able to put into effect? And then my final question is, how will you hold yourself accountable? In this segment, what I want to do is walk you through a change management strategy to help you address conflict as a key element of change. I'm not going to leave you hanging and tell you what to do without telling you exactly how. And I think that this is going to help you really close the deal on resolving conflict. Let's take a look. Leaders need frameworks. And here is one of my favorite. If you've taken any of my courses or heard me speak in the past, you will know that I refer to the emotional cycle of change repeatedly because we need frameworks. We need a place from which to stimulate our thinking and to help walk people in our organizations and on our teams through processes. When you introduce any type of change, a new leader, a new strategy, a new team member, a new goal, whatever it is, you're shifting the status quo of the organization from comfort and control and shifting them into this new way of thinking. Even if they know the change is coming and is necessary, you're going to run into some sort of challenge in that process. I'm always surprised by leaders who are surprised by conflict because they told people the change was coming. And that's fine. They knew the change was coming. They just didn't experience the effect of the change until it actually occurred. So again, they might not be operating at a high level of emotional intelligence. So let's walk through this model. You have comfort and control. You introduce something new. All of those things that I just described, a new leader, a change, a new strategy, a new team member, a goal, whatever it is, you've introduced something. Immediately, people begin to look back to the comfort and control because that's where they were most comfortable. They knew the processes, they knew the systems. Now there's a threat that seeks to disrupt their way of doing things. That can lead them to feeling fearful, getting angry, having anxiety, and then ultimately resistance and feel that feeling of chaos if you don't address stage three. Allow them to ask questions, to explore, to experiment, to discover, to push back. All of those things lead into stage five, and it is a critical, necessary step to get people to look forward and to get back into a place of stability. If you skip stage three, and this is where I tend to spend most of my time with clients between stage two, they call me in on stage two, and I got to move them through stage three so they can get to stage four. If you skip stage three, you're going to go from stage one to fear and anxiety. You're going to press through it and say, we're going to do this anyway. We're going to adopt this new way of being. And what's going to happen is you're going to cycle through one, two, and four over and over and over again. And eventually you'll have strategic drift and you will not achieve your goals. I promise you, this is the cycle that most organizations find themselves going through. It is a painful process to go from stage two through stage three because most of us as leaders and having been in senior and executive senior roles, I know when I have my mind made up as a leader on what I want to do, I don't want pushback. I just want people to fall in line most of the time if we're really honest with ourselves. But what I found over the years is when I get the feedback and I hear from other people who are actually doing the work, not only do I have greater buy-in, but it actually serves to make my processes even better. So don't skip stage three. Even if you pull in a facilitator, you do it yourself. You got to pass through that painful part of chaos, that feeling of chaos to get people to looking forward. But it does involve talking to the people and hearing what they have to say about the change. You can use this framework or you can find one that you like better, but I felt that it was really important to introduce something that you can adopt and adapt to your organization's culture. You never take a framework on its face. It always needs some sort of shifting. You can use this framework or you can find one that you like that's better. Regardless of the framework you decide to use, make sure that you adapt it to your organization's culture. Here's your homework assignment. I want you to look at a framework that resonates with you. You can adapt this one, as I've said, or you can find another one. And then I want you to examine stage three. Pick a conflict, pick a change that you're going through, that you've experienced, or one that you anticipate. And I want you to look at the opportunities that exist in your culture to ensure that you don't skip this step, that you actually are able to walk the organization through this very painful step at times. But you do it over and over, eventually it's no longer painful, it's a part of the process. Before you jump into the conversation to resolve conflict, there's just one tiny piece of information I need to help you explore that will really seal the deal on a highly effective and engaging experience for all, and one that has everything to do with setting up the conversation and knowing how the individuals involved approach conflict. Let's take a look. The first thing that I need for you to do is to assess the situation. This is the what the heck is going on stage of the conflict. Do not take sides either in word, in deed, in sidebar conversations, or in body language. If you're facilitating the conversation, you need to remain as neutral and visibly neutral as you possibly can. Your job is to collect as much information from all parties as you can. And most of the time, there will be a combination of these particular bullet points to a situation. They're not always taken in isolation. You could have a personality clash and confusion over a task or assignment. It could be approach to culture and a confusion around assignments and personality clashes. You could have all four because people don't like not knowing what's going to happen. So ambiguity could make them feel like they don't have clarity on what's expected of them. So don't look at these in isolation. Get to the bottom of what's going on. And remember, it could be any combination of these bullets or other bullets that we might not have listed here. The next thing you have to do is to determine the individual's approach to conflict. And this includes your own as a facilitator of the conflict. The next thing you have to do is determine the individual's approach to conflict. This includes your own as the facilitator of the conflict. If one or more of the individuals tend to shy away from conflict And as a facilitator, you like to address it head on. What's the likelihood that they're going to trust you to successfully manage the situation? Don't make the mistake nor allow others to force their conflict style on the other person involved in the situation. This includes you. Find common and safe ground to resolve the conflict. Now, when you look at being a conflict seeker, I tend to fall in this category, and I blame it on my upbringing and growing up in a house of men, strong-minded mother, and all the boys that were constantly wreaking havoc at my house. I had to learn how to fight with my fist and my mouth. So by the time I reached the work world, I was a hot mess. I hated passive aggressive, or what I referred to as mousy people, people who didn't speak up, who wouldn't speak up, and had no patience whatsoever with anyone. This was before emotional intelligence was a thing, so I had to learn it on my own, and that was not easy. Lots of hurt feelings, broken relationships, and leaders who were willing to be honest with me about how my conduct, my attitude, and my behavior were eroding away at my performance record. This is what people like me need. They need feedback. If you're a conflict seeker, or the person that is involved in the conflict tends to lose patience, they're eager to engage, and the person that they're engaging is a conflict avoider, there's no end in that situation. You have to help them become more self-aware and to manage their emotions, or else the conflict will not come to an end. So make a decision. Know what your style is. Know the style of the individuals coming to the table. Are they both conflict seekers, conflict avoiders? Do you have one or the other? But know the type of individuals you're going to have in that situation so that you can better manage the situation. Here are the five ways to resolve conflict. The difference between doing nothing and abandoning the conflict is that in doing nothing, the individual simply allow the conflict to take its own course of action, and this can be very effective. This can also occur when there is an expected end to the situation and the conflict will naturally subside. Abandoning the conflict, however, is literally leaving the situation completely. And we find that when people who apply to go into other departments, they leave their job, or they just completely quit the organization. Now, here's your homework assignment. What is your natural conflict style? Is your style helping to resolve conflict, or is it hurting the conflict? What parts of this approach resonate most? And then what are you going to do with what you've learned? Now, let's get into the ABCs and the 1, 2, 3s of having that conflict conversation. Now that we've laid the groundwork for resolving the conflict, which includes sending some questions to have them ponder in advance, to understanding the root cause and how they might approach the conflict, including our potential solutions, here's another easy-to-adopt model for having that conflict coaching conversation. Let's walk through this model together. The first part of this model is about framing the conversation. For example, one person speaks at a time, you know, what happens here stays in here, sort of that Vegas conversation. What you're doing is you're setting the tone for the entire experience. And the goal is to have each individual, as well as yourself, come prepared to discuss options. This is not a time for venting and getting all of your emotions out there on the table. So that's framing the conversation. The next part of this model is about establishing a common goal. When we look to establish a common goal, we want to do so for both parties. Because when you think about it, there's a certain kind of way people are feeling about what has happened or what is happening to them. So we need both parties to walk away feeling like there is a goal for them to achieve. Because after the conflict, you may have to have a follow-up coaching conversation with them individually about the goal. But it needs to be common, and they both need to agree to what that goal is going to be. And then you discuss ways to achieving the goal. And don't forget this. Talk about the barriers to the common goal. What are the obstacles to us living up to achieving this goal? What's going to get in the way? And then how do we work around those barriers? So don't just leave it up in the air like, oh, these are the barriers. I want you to talk about ways in that conversation to overcome those barriers. The third part of this is about agreements and accountability. You want them to feel... So I'm looking and reading at the same time. All right. The third part of this is about agreements and accountability. Now, some people will feel they didn't get enough time to express their emotions, but they've done enough of that outside of the room. This is not the time to sit back and talk about how someone is feeling. This is the time to move the conversation forward, not to emote. So make sure that's clear at the onset of this conversation. And don't forget to ask the question after the accountability session. What do you think will happen if either or both of you do not uphold your end of the accountability agreement? Don't forget to ask the question after the accountability question. What do you think will happen if either or both of you do not uphold your end of the accountability? This has a way of making them both think about the consequences instead of you having to show up as a hammer and a punisher. Your goal is to make them want to take responsibility for their actions. And this is just one of the approaches to help you get there. Here's a little tip that I want to add to this conversation. And it's one that I use often when I'm working with others through conflict, or I'm teaching conflict or conflict coaching. And this is one I want you to remember. And it's how to avoid escalation. When you argue statements, it only leads to an escalated argument in the conflict. I'm trying to one-up you, you're trying to one-up me, we're not hearing one another. So stop arguing points. I want you to get people instead, and maybe this is a point for you, I want you to mitigate the argument with questions. So even if you're in the middle of an argument, or as I've been in the position as a leader, but not necessarily arguing, but you raise a point, or you put something up and you talk about a direction and someone says, well, that's not going to work. Well, instead of saying, what do you mean that's not going to work? Of course it's going to work. And you're arguing point for point. I want you to ask some open-ended or some more powerful questions to get them to think. For example, as you see listed here, well, what part of the plan do you think has the best chance for success? And then you may get a flip answer. Person doesn't know, or they may say something a little flip. And then you can come back. Well, let's start with why you believe the idea wasn't effective, or whatever it is their point was. What you're trying to do here is to talk them off of this ledge of negativity and move them more into a positive thinking space. They might be very linear and they need a more creative approach to thinking about something, but you may have to bring them along kicking and screaming and talk them into more of this open space. There is something that they're thinking. They just haven't figured out how to communicate that. So they go into a negative space because it's more comfortable for them. Your job as a conflict coach is to help talk them off the ledge and to get them into a safe space to really be able to articulate what they're trying to convey. Managing the conflict for strategic impact means that we communicate broadly how we're going to address conflict. And I mean, do that in the organization. The organization should have communicated a strategy or a plan for how we're going to address conflict. And then I want you to train all staff in conflict and conflict approaches and conflict methods and techniques. From there, get in the habit of debriefing conflict situations for broader key learnings. What do we take away from this? What are you learning? What can we do differently the next time? Always look for the third option in conflict. In other words, remember when I said, if there are two people in a situation, there should be three potential outcomes. What is it that we're missing by being perched on each side of this fence? Look for the other option. And then help everyone in the organization, all staff, work on becoming more emotionally intelligent. Finally, let's summarize the four steps to conflict leadership. Framing the conversation, establishing a common goal, creating agreements, and then asking for accountability. Your homework? I want you to think about what you've learned thus far in the course, how it can benefit you, your leaders, and your teams. And I want you to think about what you're going to do now with what you know. There's still more to come, but I want you to kind of pause and sort of meditate on that for a minute. And then what are you going to do with this strategy? When will you put it in place? And how can we be of support to you? What I've done is given you the information needed to formulate the creation of a framework to inform your conflict strategy. Your next step is to use this information to prepare and to frame the elements of a strategy you want to implement. Execution, therefore, is the decision that you need to make and the activities that must be performed throughout the organization with the objective of meeting goals outlined in your conflict strategy. There are 7 elements of strategic execution that I want to review as we sort of sum this up, and that you will see in the conflict outline, the conflict strategy outline that we've provided as part of this course. You've got planning, you've got people, performance management, communication, capacity, KPIs, and accountability. Planning ensures that what we want to do is actually aligned within the organization. People then has to do with having the talent, the skills, the capabilities, and the bench strength to achieve our goals. Do we buy the talent? Do we borrow the talent? Do we develop the talent that we need? Performance management then is the foundational layer that is required to help us integrate accountability and bake it into the organization's culture. Communication is exactly what it means. It means having a shared understanding of what to do and what is to be accomplished. KPIs are the key performance indicators for how we are performing. How do we know we're actually on task to achieve our goals? And accountability is how we're going to hold ourselves and others accountable so we avoid strategic drift. Who will be responsible for holding our attention to the goals? As you work through the conflict strategy that we've provided, these are the questions that you will need to answer. I encourage you to take a high-level look and take an individual approach to answering these. But then you may also want to bring others in and create a committee or a task force to help you look at conflict more broadly to have a more shared understanding and a shared concept for how you're going to address conflict throughout the organization. Well, this concludes our course on resolving conflict at work. I want you to make sure you take the steps necessary to complete the course and to receive your certificate of completion. Finally, please let us know how we can support your continued efforts to embrace conflict by creating a coaching culture.